extraordinarily useful.
You leave NDC in what, late 64, 65?
No, NDC, that course graduated in July of 1964, and I was posted to Ottawa then. It was still Air Force headquarters, but by September, October of 1964, of course, it had become National Defense Headquarters. Or what do they call it? I guess they call it Canadian CFHQ, Canadian Forces Headquarters, by then. And let's just leave it there for a second.
We're back on graduating in from NDC.
In July.
Going to Ottawa with the Canadian Forces Headquarters in Ottawa.
Well,
for you, it was Air Force Headquarters.
Yeah, first I was Air Force Headquarters, and I became the director of postings and careers in RCF Headquarters. That had under it the senior at the directorate level, the senior personnel directorate, postings and careers of all officers and airmen, I think up to the rank of squadron leader, wing commander. Another shop handled the more senior postings. And I was the last RCF DPC, and remained at that. I'm scratching for months here now. By October, I guess, of 1964, we were well into detail planning towards a unified personnel shop for all three services. There were still in existence the RCF equivalent of postings and careers in both Army and Navy at the colonel captain level in their case, and the three of us and other planning committees were working now on the, I guess the right word is integration here, the integration of the three activities under one Director General of Postings and Careers, DGPC. And the first DGPC was a naval commodore, and what an excellent choice that was. He was a very wise guy. A fellow named Stu Padden, Commodore Stu Padden, became a rear admiral later on and retired in Ottawa. But it was Padden's job now to pull together all of the personnel policies that had been refined, developed, discarded, reinstituted of the three services into a single personnel policy for the Armed Forces of Canada. And if you think that wasn't a trick, but we got on with it. We got on with it. And we examined policy by policy what we did about, promotion policy, of course, was a significant one. The Army particularly was still essentially on a seniority promotion policy. As you became senior, if you hadn't seriously blotted your copybook, you eventually got promoted. This would be up to the rank of probably lieutenant colonel or even colonel. The Navy, as I recall, had a similar one, but there was a greater touch of merit in their promotion policy.
Yeah, but you were guaranteed to make lieutenant commander in the Navy, weren't you?
Yes. That was that. I don't know the word would be guaranteed.
Well, I use that as
yeah. But it was highly likely you'd make lieutenant commander. In the case of the RCF, and I'll say this honestly, ours had been a merit system for as long as I could remember.
Was it more a pilot system, sir?
Pilot? You mean pilot? A flying pilot or a model?
Flying pilot.
No, that applied to all branches.
Well, I'm thinking of navigators and things. They couldn't get the same.
No, but you see, we had there were combined air crew, pilots, navigators, mm-hmm. radio officers, flight engineers, as that was the air branch. But then there was the...
What I'm getting at is that most senior officers from Air Force seem to be pilots, as opposed to navigators, gunners, engineers.
That is true. That is true.
And that's why I'm saying if you're a pilot, if you're in the pilot stream, you've got a better shot at promotion. Or at least that's the way it appeared.
That's the way it appeared. You can argue figures here forever, but you're quite right. The RCF, as was most air forces in those days, the United States Air Force and RAF, it was a pilot's air force, no question about it. But I repeat, whereas that might be so, and was indeed so, a pilot's air force, there were many, many other branches, you see.
Oh, yes, fair enough. But I think the standard, what we're getting at in comparisons for the three service and promotion, if I'm not mistaken, like a two-bar captain or a, what do they call, flight lieutenant.
Flight lieutenant.
RCF. Was a respectable rank to retire at.
Yes.
In the Navy, it seemed to be lieutenant commander.
Yes.
And in the Army, it was major, half colonel, colonel.
I'm
just making, these are pretty wide brush.
General, yeah. Generality.
Would you agree with it? Would you agree with that?
Well, certainly in the case of air crew. A great many air crew retired at the rank of flight lieutenant, but you recall that we retired them, that we had a graduated rank retirement age, particularly, and air crew were 2 years younger than anyone else. For instance, if you were, let's take an air commodore in the supply branch, an air commodore retired at 53, an air commodore in the air branch retired at 51. That kind of thing. Whereas in the case of the Army and the Navy, I think they all retired at essentially the same age. I could be wrong here. Mm-hmm. But the idea here, in the case of the Air Force, if a chap was going to retire as a flight lieutenant, he retired, I think, as early as 45 or 47, giving him an opportunity to start another career. Kind of late in life to start another career, but he was retired early, and one prime reason for that early retirement was to give the man a chance to start another career. But in any event, we're getting into specific policies now. But we had to pull all of this together. All of things like leave, how much leave did people get during the year, and a prime problem was the assessment form we used to rate a man, or a woman for that matter.
Want to get a common form?
Now we're going to try and get a common form. And dear Lord, that went on. When I left in 66, it was still being argued. And eventually, a common form came out, which nobody liked, but we used.
Like the uniform, the last of all the evils?
Oh Lord. Fortunately, I never did get involved in the uniform hassle. You know, I was finally told to wear that one, I screamed as loudly as anyone else. But
what about the uniform itself? The green. I have to ask all people about the green.
It was a hell of a shock when it appeared. I think I first saw it. I was down in Mobile Command. I'd been posted to Mobile Command in 66, and of course, Expo 67 coming online, and the military contribution to Expo had to be in the new greens. So I got my first look at the new greens in action, if you like, on a troop of I think of the Van Dues, who were forming an honor guard for some activity, and there wasn't a spontaneous round of applause at that point in time. But later on, when I became air attaché down in Washington and arrived in my green uniform, I had grown to find some merit in it, and it was distinctive. I was not, as a Canadian airman, I was not confused with my RAF counterpart, who was air attaché over in the British Embassy, nor indeed with the New Zealanders or the Australians. You know, Canadian green was getting to be known. The But the story that started almost immediately amongst airmen was that we couldn't decide on what... Well, we, the Canadian forces, couldn't decide on what green it was. And so the airmen said, the Army think it's rifle green, and the Navy think it's sea green, and the airmen know that it's airsick green.
Green.
So that was a standard shot at it. But I thought the green was okay for the cooler months. But by God, having worn a light khaki during hot weather, that dark green uniform certainly sucked in the sun. And later on, when I was required to wear it for ceremonial matters and in the tropics, traveling with National Defense College, it was a brute. You stood in the sun with that in that dark green uniform, and it's still the problem, I know. It was hot. But it happened. There was a moment of trauma, but we got on with it. I think the sailors...
Well, they're still crying about it.
...were almost in hysterics over it.
Well, they still are.
And the Army, once they got it and were able to hang all their funny little...
they weren't allowed to at first.
Not at first, but when they, you know, when they finally got around to hanging all their stuff on it. Airmen never... We wore wings if we were air crew, and medals and Canada badges and our rank badges, and we just didn't hang anything else on our uniforms.
Well, unfortunately, the shortcoming of a common uniform is that we have to emulate the Americans in the sense of hanging anchors, and I'm thinking of Maritime Command, and and goodies off the jacket to indicate that I should be wearing blue or khaki, which almost seems self-defeating.
Yeah.
But what about the unification fiasco when Landy Moore packs it in, when others... The Navy has their sacrificial lambs. The Army is crying in its beer, and the Air Force is, well, as the story has been told to me time and time again, and which you're well aware of, the Air Force were ordering new green uniforms. The Air Force was the bad guy. What reaction? Like, I know you didn't have any personal.
Yeah.
As you mentioned.
No, that. But I was in the. In the personnel branch, where all of this heat eventually arrived, these were people problems, and of course the personnel staff were the so-called experts on people. So it was hot and heavy. I told you that I worked for at the very beginning for. This great first Director General of Postings and Careers, Stu Padden, Commodore, and the naval mess was... We were in the so-called Lisgar building in that complex of three buildings on Cartier Square in Ottawa, and we used to go across, particularly on a Friday, for lunch at Stu Padden's mess, and he'd bring me and invite me and the Army Colonel, who was the head of the old Army personnel postings and careers game, and of course our naval equivalent, a fellow named Dan Hannington. And the discussions were absolutely violent. Of course, each day over in that naval mess, there were new developments on the East Coast and new developments on the West Coast, people retiring, throwing themselves into the sea and all the rest of the stuff.
Falling on their swords.
Falling on their swords, stabbing themselves with their medals. And a real horror story. Now, throughout this, I'm sure the picture was that the whole of the Navy was in revolt. Well, it didn't come through that way.
You had your opportunist looking too,
in the senior naval crowd who messed right there on Lister Street. Some of them certainly, but the more junior officers, at the lieutenant, colonel, and commander, looking up at their admirals and their commodores doing these strange dances, Many of them were bemused. They didn't know what was going on. None of us really knew what the hell was going on. Of course, all of this moved in the greatest of secrecy. Gray-faced men stalking the halls and so. But I think in the case of Landimore, it seemed to me that the issue he chose did not do the Navy proud, if you like. And you got that. All right, you get that. Yeah, you're gonna have second guessing.
Boy.
20 years later.
Navy and Landimore is like a soup and a sandwich. Come on, now.
Is that right?
From most, with the exception of one.
Well,
of the admirals that I've talked to, Landimore is the fair-haired boy.
All right, I'm being quite specific when I make that statement. I'm saying with the group around Ottawa with whom I discussed it at that point in time, that was not the impression I got.
Fair enough.
Now I could have been mistaken.
No.
But we had some pretty damn frank discussions, and similarly with the Army, you know, people like Bob Monsell opted out, Frank Fleury, and
well, Monsell was a pretty capable lad, was he not?
Very capable guy, very capable. As was Fleury. Fleury was a most able man, you know, and a very sensible, experienced professional. I got the sensation of a great deal more emotion on the part of the senior naval guys. There was another great admiral that went. Was it Bob Welland? Was it Welland that?
A rack of them.
Yeah.
40-odd retired early or some damn thing over a period of years, wasn't it?
I don't think so. 40-odd.
According to one admiral in town.
Naval,
that was the excuse, obviously, yeah, for every time somebody retired.
Naval arithmetic baffles me sometimes, but
the senior people, I think, is what he was getting.
I don't remember. I don't remember that. I really don't remember that. I remember Landimore. I remember Welland. Welland was right there in the headquarters. A little later on, a fellow like Vice Admiral Ken Dyer, who became Chief of Personnel, and was a fine man. When I cast about, I'd be hard pressed to name 10, and that's far short of 40.
40.
Your figure.
Fair enough. Wasn't my figure, was an admiral's figure.
Well, yeah, the figure you
that I pumped
you,
out there.
You pumped out.
What about the antagonism towards the Air Force, as the Air Force as being the snake in the grass, if you will? And I'm sure you've heard this argument. We've talked about it off tape.
Yeah. Well,
I hate playing devil's advocate.
No. You should. But and maybe I moved zombie-like throughout the whole period. But I worked closely with sailors in the personnel business in 63 and 64, and then, I'm sorry, 63, 64, 65, and then in 66 I went down to Mobile Command in Montreal, and that was the very heart of the Army, a single command now instead of the several regional commands. So I was hard against these others, and I personally didn't feel under attack. I was the senior airman down in Mobile Command. I was one of many airmen in the Canadian Forces headquarters, and I worked side by side with my rank equivalents. They mumbled and grumbled, but it wasn't as vitriolic as it is now being described as having been.
Yes.
In my experience. Now, what they were saying privately, damned if I know, and didn't particularly care. We were getting on with them.
Well, let me put it to you this way, sir. The case that I've
encountered, or at least the case that's been presented to me time and time again, is when it comes down to the basis, is that though the Air Force didn't initiate unification, they were behind it 99% or 100%.
Well, I wonder who they were. When you say they were behind it, you mean they were for it?
I mean the force, the whole Air Force, the RCAF.
We were for it.
Was
we were unification. we were pro unification. Well, unification, first of all, the RCAF had been a functional organization. We were not geographic. We were functional. Do you take the distinction here?
Yes.
That we had an air defense command that roamed the whole of Canada. We had an air transport command that roamed around the world and Canada, and a maritime command and a training command, and these were entirely functional. The other two organizations tended to be geographic. Certainly, the Army was.
Mm-hmm.
Geographic commands across Canada.
Well, you combine ships and regiments with the whole history and everything else.
Yeah, well, that wasn't changing. You know, despite the heat and the sentiment, that stuff was not changing from where I sat. And I sat pretty close to it in Mobile Command when you talk regiments. And of course, the Navy were on the east and the west coast. And we were all closed corporations, no question about it. So-called pulled together by the chiefs of staff at the top, the way the Brits are to this very day, and the Americans. So as we moved into a more functional look for the Canadian forces, there were very few mysteries to us. The other two services had not had the experience, and we seemed to have, well, we clearly had fewer fears. We knew how the functional game was going to be played. You know, we knew what a functional look was all about. We knew what a functional approach could do. Now that would be the attitude of the Air Force. I heard airmen saying, "God, sir, you think they're going to put a colonel of the infantry in charge of a 104 squadron?" Or you talk to a soldier and say, "You know, I fully expect the sailor to be running the van dues." Well, that was frivolous, and totally inaccurate, and you were forever saying, "Don't be a bloody fool." You know, that's not going to happen, and it never has happened. No, it flattering never has happened.
Devil's advocate yet.
No, and we would be, professionally, we would be idiots if we ever tried that.
Okay.
Hard professionalism, certainly up to the rank of lieutenant colonel, and then as you move into broader staffs, it's true. But I don't know what responsibility the RCF should assume in all of this. These discussions were going on at the. Remember, I was a group captain. I never did become a colonel. I went from group captain to air commodore to brigadier general. So I was a group captain, and the stuff I was doing with my Army and Navy counterparts was the best we could do based on the kind of staff experience we had. On the personnel side, we thought we were doing, all three of us thought we were doing pretty damn good, sensible work. Some of it, one of us would shake our heads and say, "I'll never be able to sell that to my guys." And if that was really so, we probably didn't go that route. But usually you found...
Well, you see, when you say that, I've heard the Air Force could always say, "I could go with that."
Well, that's mischievous, and I would say grossly inaccurate.
Thank you.
Grossly
much.
Inaccurate.
Okay.
Not from my experience.
That's what we're after. You were there, I wasn't.
I was there.
Okay.
Well, no, I was there in the personnel business.
No, but you were in Ottawa, and you were senior enough to catch what was happening. You stay in Ottawa until when, sir?
Ottawa, 64 until 66.
Then to Mobile Command.
Yeah, I became what was known as the director of senior appointments after my my DPC thing. And senior appointments simply meant that I ran the careers, I guess that's a good expression. I was responsible for career development, postings and careers for wing commanders and above, and was director of senior appointments under two Army brigadiers this time. I'd served as airman's postings and careers under a naval commodore, and now across to DGSE, Director General Senior Appointments, and I had one Army brigadier followed by another. And found the sledding there under my Army bosses, really heavier than I had under my RCN boss, Commodore Patton. I found the Army very, very rigid, and I found a touch of seniority was the thing. And I remember one of my Army brigadier bosses would say, yes, he's a good man, he is probably a pretty good professional, but he didn't marry well. There was a touch of social snobbery in the person of one of these brigadiers. I wouldn't broad brush and say that the whole of the Army was like that, but here was the Director General of Senior Appointment, as much concerned about still about social graces and less with professional abilities, I sensed, than I would wish to have experienced in the RCF, and indeed never did. But in any event, in 66, I remember being called in by the deputy chief of personnel and saying, you were promoted air commodore and you were going down to be, and I'll never forget this title, Chief of Staff, Force Requirements and Doctrine in Mobile Command. Chief of Staff, Force Requirements and Doctrine. It had a hell of a ring to it. I hadn't the faintest idea.
You're joining the church.
I hadn't the faintest idea what it meant. And I went down to Mobile Command. The headquarters then was in Longueuil, outside Montreal. And I learned that my new boss was going to be Major General Bill... No, Lieutenant General. Lieutenant General Bill Anderson, about whom I knew nothing, but off we went in 66. And that's a story in itself. I've got to make one telephone call. Hang on.
Think past.
Mobile Command. Well, by 66, were there four geographic commands of the Canadian Army? There was Western Command, Central, Quebec, and they didn't call it Maritime Command. Well, I guess they called it Eastern Command, with headquarters in Halifax. Those four headquarters, each commanded by a major general, had now been consolidated into a single headquarters, Mobile Command, in Montreal. And here assembled in Mobile Command was the right to say, I suppose, the concentrated professional talent of the Canadian Army. In addition to the normal staff, a personnel staff, and an operations staff, and so on, there were the chiefs of the arms, and they were the greatest living, allegedly the greatest living experts in the specific arm, chief of infantry, armor, artillery, field engineers, communications. What else? And now we had an airman down there, and these all at the colonel level with staffs. And now we had a chief of tactical aviation, because tactical aviation fitted logically under in an army environment. But I was the senior airman as air commodore. But I was off in this other staff, this chief of staff force requirements and doctrine, with a sprinkling of airmen through this whole headquarters. I think one sailor, a rear admiral who was a deputy commander for logistics. There was a commander, then a deputy commander for logistics, and a deputy commander for operations. But as the senior airman there, I was also looked upon as, to use the Army term, the greatest living airman in Mobile Command. That was a term they loved using, the greatest living this and the greatest living that. I've picked it up myself. It's useful. But by 66, the size of the Army had not been settled. The structure of the Army had really not been settled in this new look. We simply didn't know, and this went on for, I think, for most of my three years. Let's say I was there from 66 to 69. During my 3 years there, the size of Mobile Command in terms of their slice of the personnel pie of the Canadian Forces had not stabilized. It was constant shrinkage, and you'd be given a Mobile Command. The commander would be given a figure for Ottawa. You know, build a structure around 25,000 positions or 35,000 positions or whatever. So we'd work day and night, and you know, so many battalions and so many batteries and so many bases and so on, and we'd just get the damn thing finished, and the word would come down, whoops, not 35 or 25, you better try it now with 33 or 23. So we'd go through the whole bloody generation again, including the tactical aviation slice that was to have gone into Mobile Command. And that was to be the fair of that command. All commands were going through the same thing. But it seemed to be a particular horror story down in Mobile because of trying to get together. You're right.
How effective could you have been during this period?
First of all, the terrible problem of how many infantry armored and artillery regiments were to be maintained, retained and maintained, with a problem that I hadn't in the case of infantry, the question of rebadging between regiments, I hadn't realized.